Thank you, Kelly. I have no disclosures. Well, this previous advertisement reads that Coke is like family, you can never have enough. So I thought it would be only fair to begin today by considering the potential benefits of sugar-sweetened beverage. And I conducted a search of the world's literature, and I found this one possibility, clinically proven superior hydration benefit compared to water. But then when I sought the source, it was Kraft Foods in the Wall Street Journal, not a peer-reviewed journal. The potential adverse effects are better documented, and they fall into these categories: negative impact on diet quality, obesity, type 2 diabetes, cardiovascular disease, gout, osteoporosis, dental caries, and possibly cancer. In the 12 minutes that I have to review the science, I will focus just on obesity and also limit my summary of the evidence to children, the most critical topic today. So the data regarding sugar-sweetened beverages and obesity in children fall into four categories: cross-sectional studies, prospective observational studies, randomized controlled trials, and then physiological mechanisms. After considering each of these categories, I'll make a comment about inconsistency in the literature. So with regard to cross-sectional studies, there are a total of 10, and two of them relate to impact on energy balance. The first study by Harnack, involving 1,800 children participating in the continuing survey of food intake by individuals, found that intake was directly associated with total energy intake, directly associated with sugar-sweetened beverages, found that consumers took in about 200 calories a day more than non-consumers when controlling for confounders. Together with Steve Gortmaker and his colleagues at the School of Public Health, we looked at about 3,000 children and adolescents in a nationally representative survey, the NHANES 2003 and 4, using a within-subject comparison between 2 days. We found that each additional serving of sugar-sweetened beverage consumption corresponded to a net increase of about 100 calories per day, and that replacing all sugar-sweetened beverages with water would produce an estimated 235 kilocalorie per day decrease in energy intake. That is much of the so-called energy gap, which is thought to be responsible for the childhood obesity epidemic. With regard to the studies that link sugar-sweetened beverages and body weight or obesity, there are 5 positive studies showing a positive relationship that range from about 100 to about 10,000 individuals, increasingly in studies around the world, including now Jamaica, Saudi Arabia. I won't review these individually in the interest of time. There are 3 cross-sectional studies that show no association, and there are notably no studies that show the inverse. In other words, if the data were just randomly distributed, you'd expect potentially as many positive associations as inverse associations. So 5 positive, 3 neutral. But this is the weakest line of research because of the high likelihood of residual confounding and reverse causality. Thus, the importance of prospective studies, which look at baseline or change in consumption as it impacts weight status longitudinally. Again, together with Steve Gortmaker and Karen Peterson, we looked at consumption among 548 middle school students over 19 months, assessing sugar-sweetened beverages with a food frequency questionnaire, and we found that controlling for confounders, every additional serving of soft drink per day increased the risk of becoming obese by 60%. Berkeley did a 2-year study with about 10,000 children in the Growing Up Today study, the GUT study, and found that increased consumption had a modest but significant positive association with BMI, in effect attributed to increased total energy intake. Phillips did a 10-year study of 141 girls and found that sugar-sweetened beverage was the only snack food associated with BMI. Walsh did a 1-year study of 10,000 children, very young children, 2 to 3 years old, and found that they were 2 times more likely to become or remain obese if they drank sugar-sweetened beverages. Fiorito looked at 170 white girls from ages 5 to 15 years and found that sugar-sweetened beverage consumption at age 5, but not milk or fruit juice, was positively associated with weight status, waist circumference, and body fatness over 10 years. And Lim looked at 365 low-income African-American preschool children for 2 years and found that sugar-sweetened beverages at baseline were significantly associated with the incidence of obesity. There are 2 negative studies, one by Newby, but this was of children 2 to 5 years, so a very early age, very young age, with very low levels of consumption. And another negative study of a 2 years duration of 164 children, mean age of 9, finding no association with sugar-sweetened beverages, but actually a positive association with diet soft drink consumption. So as for the randomized controlled trials, there are 3. James did a cluster randomized controlled trial of 600 children ages 7 to 11, and the intervention was to was an educational campaign to decrease all fizzy drinks, and that included artificially sweetened beverages as well. There was less than a 2 ounce per day difference in sugar-sweetened beverages as a consequence of this intervention. So it was, from the standpoint of intensity, a rather weak intervention, and they got no overall difference in BMI. However, the incidence of overweight and obesity was significantly lower in the intervention group, 0.2 versus 7.7%. In a similarly designed study by Sicheri, the intervention also accomplished less than 2 ounces per day decrease in sugar-sweetened beverages, also no difference in overall BMI. But among the obese students, BMI decreased by 0.4 units, an effect that was not statistically significant for boys and girls, but was statistically significant for girls. We did a differently designed randomized controlled trial. This was 6 months and involved 103 non-obese and obese adolescents consuming at least 12 ounces of sugar-sweetened beverage per day. So there was a bigger window for seeing an effect. And the intervention consisted of delivery of non-caloric beverages to the intervention group's homes to try to displace sugar-sweetened beverages. And we, in fact, accomplished that, at least based on report, that we eliminated 82% of beverage consumption in the intervention group. And here's what we found. This slide shows the change in BMI along the y-axis as a function of baseline BMI. And we saw a statistical interaction. In other words, the greater the baseline BMI, the greater the decrease in BMI. And that makes sense. I mean, sugar-sweetened beverages aren't necessary to maintain weight in normal-weight children from them becoming underweight. So one would expect there to be a bigger effect among overweight and obese children. And when we looked at the individuals above a BMI of 25, the tertile and the heaviest tertile, we found a statistically significant 3/4 of a unit BMI decrease. This finding may help to explain the negative findings regarding overall effect in the 2 other randomized controlled trials, which both looked at normal and overweight and obese populations. So it may be that targeting the obese is where we're going to be getting the biggest effect. So finally, in terms of physiological mechanisms, there's no clear evidence that sugar consumption per se promotes food intake or obesity in a unique manner. Now, this is a hotly debated topic, but it's not considered proven. But sugar in liquid form may be especially problematic because of its inherently lower satiating abilities. This study by DiMiglio and Matis looked at sugar in solid form, jelly beans, or soft drinks, 450 calories per day, and its effects on intake of all other foods and drinks shown along the y-axis. And you can see that the jelly beans displaced almost exactly as many calories as they provided, leading to no difference in total energy intake. But in the soda condition, there was no decrease in overall total energy intake from other foods and beverages, and thus those 450 calories added to the day's energy balance. Thus, calories in liquid form may slip under the body's calorie-regulating homeostatic systems. A possible long-term mechanism relates to sugar a concept of glycemic index or load. The glycemic index describes how a controlled amount of a food affects blood sugar in the postprandial period. Refined carbohydrates in general and concentrated sugars in particular tend to have a big impact on blood sugar. Glycemic load for sugar-sweetened beverages is especially high. That concept is the multiplicative product of glycemic index and amount of carbohydrate. So if you're eating a high glycemic index food that has a lot of carbohydrate, it's going to raise blood sugar a lot. And when we looked at it, the impact of this factor in a feeding study with obese adolescents, we found, as expected, that blood sugar is highest after a high glycemic meal compared to a medium or low, but that blood sugar comes down rapidly and then tends to go into the relatively hypoglycemic range a few hours later. And that drop-off in blood sugar is associated with increased hunger and overeating. The subjects in our study, when given free access to food, ate 600 or 700 calories more after a high glycemic meal than a low. And in this, I think, somewhat definitive study published recently in the New England Journal of Medicine looking at weight loss maintenance, the low glycemic meal diet led to no weight regain after a total of 8% body weight loss. The high glycemic load diet led to the most rapid weight regain, and the medium glycemic load diets led to intermediate results. So lastly, a comment about inconsistency in the literature. We know that there is extensively documented bias in pharmaceutical research, but the issue hasn't been well evaluated in the area of nutrition. So we looked at the relationship between between sponsorship and conclusion among scientific articles pertaining to milk, fruit juices, and sugar-sweetened beverages over a five-year period. And we had different groups of investigators analyzing conclusions and financial sponsorship. We looked at 206 articles. 111 had declared financial sponsorship, actually suggesting that disclosure is by no means complete. And we found that the odds ratio of a favorable versus an unfavorable finding regarding the beverage under study was 4 to 8-fold greater if the study was exclusively funded by the industry. And this conclusion is consistent with that of Vartanian and from the Rudd Center and colleagues, who did a meta-analysis of 88 studies involving sugar-sweetened beverages and health, and basically found that those that were funded by the industry reported a significantly smaller effect size than did non-industry funded studies. So in summary, cross-sectional studies show both positive and no associations with body weight or obesity, but these studies are limited by confounding reverse causality and lack of power. Prospective studies are predominantly positive. Data from randomized controlled studies are limited but suggestive. Mechanistic studies provide plausible evidence for a relationship. And some of the variability in the literature may arise from bias related to financial conflicts of interest. An unresolved issue is the effects of artificially sweetened beverages on health in general and body weight. And in my final slide, I would like to announce that we will be completing a large-scale RCT later this month. 220 overweight and obese adolescents ages 13 to 17 years who consume at least 12 ounces of sugar-sweetened beverage per day. The intervention was the same that we did in our pilot study, delivery of non-caloric beverages to the home. The primary endpoint is change in BMI over a two-year period, and we've had greater than 90% participant completion, so we hope to be able to provide some definitive data in this regard very soon. Thank you for your attention. Thank you.